Mr. Garnett?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
5 minutes, okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Quantum Computer maintains that it has an implied license to drives sold by licensees, Sony and Philips, even if the drives are made by Quanta Storage. As the Court may know, the only drive addition...
Does this issue of the implied license cover all the alleged infringement here, or only part of it?
Almost all of the alleged infringement. There were a few drives very early in the damage period. It's a nominal number of drives sold directly from Quanta Storage to Quanta Computer, and we don't contend that those drives would be covered by the implied license doctrine.
Okay, and what about the relationship between the implied license argument and the exhaustion argument? Is that, do they cover the same items?
No, I believe... I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor, they would cover the same items.
Okay.
Yes. There would be no authorization under the have-made rights for drives sold directly from Quanta Storage to Quanta Computer. There's no dispute that Quanta Storage...
So in your view, if we were to rule in your favor on the implied license, there would be no reason to reach the exhaustion question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no dispute that Quanta Storage makes drives for Philips and Sony pursuant to have-made rights in those companies' licenses with Laser Dynamics. Quanta Computer does not make optical disk drives. It makes computers and assembles them for companies like HP and Dell. Relying upon the DuPont case out of Delaware, the district court found an impermissible sublicense existed when Quanta Computer purchased Quanta Storage-made drives from licensees Sony and Philips. But the DuPont case is readily distinguishable on its facts. In DuPont, the single entity, Union Carbide, both made and used all the Methomyl product at issue there. Here, Quanta Computer and Quanta Storage are separate companies. Quanta Computer owns less than 30% of the stock of Quanta Storage, and Quanta Computer does not control the day-to-day operations of Quanta Storage. Their relationship.
What you're saying is to decide whether this case falls closer to DuPont than to Cyrix, we have to examine the relationship between QCI and QSI. Or, for example, if they were one and the same, if one was the alter ego of the other, then you'd be closer to DuPont, correct?
I think we might be closer to DuPont, but I think DuPont is still distinguishable, even if the court finds that Quanta Computer and Quanta Storage are the same entity.
How so?
Okay.
How so are you still safe from DuPont?
Well, unlike the licensee Shell in the DuPont case, neither Sony nor Philips is required to sell all or any portion of the Quanta Storage made drives to Quanta Computer. That's very different. In DuPont, Shell was required by contract to sell back to Carbide all the Methomyl that Carbide made, making the have-made and purchase and sale transactions one and the same. There's no restriction also on Sony or Philips' have-made rights here. Unlike in the DuPont case, where there was an express prohibition on sublicensing, which the court used to evidence DuPont's intent to limit a have-made right.
But there's no sublicense right under this agreement, right?
There's not, Your Honor, but...
What you're saying is it was more emphatic. The intent was made emphatic by the fact that they wrote in, you can't sublicense, as opposed to saying, I don't have to write it in because we know you don't have it. That's your point.
It's close to my point, but what the court really did was it used the express prohibition as a limit on have-made rights, saying if there was no express prohibition on sublicensing, maybe I couldn't infer any intent on the part of DuPont to limit have-made rights. But since there was a clear express prohibition on sublicensing, I'm going to use that as evidence of DuPont's intent to limit the have-made rights. And that's also different here. There's
no refresh my recollection. What happened here is that QCI is placing orders with Philips and or Sony. Is that right? How does the commercial transaction
Right. So the commercial transaction is completely separate from the have-made rights. So most of the time...
I understand. I mean, just in terms of QSI that's making, it's not in any trouble. It's got their have-made rights.
Yeah. So Quanta Storage makes drives for Sony or Philips under their have-made rights in their agreements with Laser Dynamics.
But how do they get into the hands of QCI?
Okay. So most of the time, more than 85% of the time, and sometimes for HP, for example, 100% of the time, Dell and HP negotiate with Sony and Philips for the purchase of the drives.
Wait, I'm confused. I thought that the drives were sold by Sony and Philips to QCI. No?
Infrequently. About 15% of the time that happens.
Okay.
Predominantly, the drives are sold from Sony or Philips to HP or to Dell. Then HP or Dell will sell the drives to Quanta Computer, who assembles them into a computer and sells the computer back into the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Even when Quanta Computer buys a drive from Philips or Sony, it does so at the request of HP or Dell. And in fact, HP and Dell negotiate the price at which Quanta Computer is to buy those drives directly. So even in the situation where Quanta Computer is buying the drives, it is HP and Dell, the testimony of Mr. Yambao and Mr. Chen from HP and Dell make this very clear, they negotiate those contracts all the time.
Were HP and Dell then supplying the optical disk drives to QCI?
Yes, sir. And here's...
They're being drop-shipped by QSI, right?
Yes, thank you very much. That was my next question.
That's how they get there.
That's how they get there.
So the porters are sort of flying around on the internet, do this, buy these.
Yes,
and, but then the message comes down to QSI from presumably Dell, pardon me, from Philips or Sony, to ship these things down to QCI.
Yes, sir. And I think that's important. You know, there's no reason to require somebody to ship the drives all over the world in this situation, as long as the paper trail is clear, so that if there were perhaps a running royalty that Sony and Philips had to pay, it would show up in their books and they would pay that. So the paper
trail... Your view is that these are marketplace-driven arm's-length transactions.
Yes, sir.
And it just happens that QCI and QSI have this connection because the ultimate... purchaser probably of the computer, Dell or whatnot, is dictating whose drives are supposed to go in there, and that's what's happening.
That's correct. And it's also different than DuPont in that Quanta storage-made drives are used by the entire industry. They're not just used by Quanta Computer. So it's not a situation where all of the Quanta storage-made drives wind their way up in a Quanta Computer. Or a computer made by Quanta Computer. That's not how it works. These are market-driven transactions. The drives are sold to all the different OEMs all across the world. The contracts are negotiated by Dell and HP. Even if there's a direct purchase on the books from Quanta Computer, by Quanta Computer from Sony.
Nobody's arguing that this issue can't be resolved on summary judgment. This went off on a summary judgment, right?
It did, and I think the facts are pretty well established here. The only evidence to rebut our implied license that Laser Dynamics put forward is the fact that Quanta Computer and Quanta Storage are affiliated.
Probably, correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't understand Laser Dynamics to be saying, you know, in the event that we think there's an issue here, it has to go back for trial.
I agree.
We look at all these commercial data points and decide what the true nature of the relationship between QCI and QSI.
I think the record is fairly well developed. Yes, Your Honor.
Two companies can be affiliated and still have arm's length transactions, or at least their transactions can reflect market realities. Was there any evidence presented that that was the case?
There was no evidence presented that that was not the case. In fact,
there was evidence about a mass price.
The mass price issue is simply when HP and Dell sell the optical disk drive to Quanta Computer, they raise the price that's reflected in their books so that Quanta Computer doesn't know what they actually paid for the drive. But the mass price is always higher than the actual price of the ODD. So there's nothing mysterious about that. It's recorded as on Dell and HP's books, and they produced evidence in this case of what the actual price was. And then they produced evidence of what the mass price was. And it's just simply something that Dell and HP use to hide from the industry, if you will, what price they're actually able to get out of Sony and Dell, because it's extremely competitive. They're always looking for the lowest price possible, and Sony and Philips are always looking for the highest price possible. There's a lot of negotiations that go on between Sony and Philips and HP and Dell, and that's why they use the mass price. Nothing mysterious at all about that.
Okay, I want to reserve the, we'll give you your 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mac.
Okay,
thank you. Mr. Gaudet,
Gaudet. Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Matt Gaudet here for the plaintiff appellant, Laser Dynamics. I want to pick up with the question, Judge Clevenger, that you asked, and this is a crucial procedural clarification. We did not move for summary judgment on the issue of implied license or exhaustion. The Court did not grant us summary judgment. Frankly, somehow we missed that point in the response brief we put in, but it is unambiguous in the record. And I want to be very specific.
Then what did happen?
What did happen is that Quanta moved for summary judgment on both issues. Our response, which is at JA3596, says there's a question of fact on both issues. Alternatively, we should get a 56F additional discovery. Our SIR reply at JA7177 said exactly the same thing. Judge Ward's order does not say anything about any motion that Laser Dynamics filed because we didn't file any motion. It doesn't suggest he granted a summary judgment. That order is in the record at JA22 and 23.
So what are we supposed to draw from that?
Your Honor,
that if we rule against you on the implied license point, that you want a remand so that you can conduct more discovery?
No, Your Honor. Actually, what it means is where the record stands is that as of the time the trial started, the district court found that there was a question of fact. And the reason we didn't want to be in a position of bearing a burden on appeal of having to defend this, you know, having to deal with this as a matter of law, because these facts, as you went through, there are some complicated facts here. At that point, the defendant, who had the burden of proof on this issue, needed to put on evidence at trial on this issue, needed to have a jury charge on this issue, needed to file a pre-verdict JMOL motion on this issue, and needed to file a post-verdict JMOL motion.
You've never argued this before.
Your Honor,
is that correct?
That's correct. We filed a single brief.
Okay, so why isn't that a waiver?
Your Honor, this is not an issue on which we bear the burden of proof, and it's not an issue.
Well, yeah, so it doesn't make any difference.
And I wondered, that's why I raised the issue, was that I'm reading what I'm saying, and I'm saying there may well be some real issues of fact here as to what's the true relationship in these transactions, but I'm not seeing anywhere in the appeal up here to say the error was X.
Your Honor, to be clear, we filed a single brief on this issue. And it was following the brief that the plaintiff put in, where they incorrectly said summary judgment was granted. That it's simply false.
So you didn't challenge that,
Your Honor. I don't know how it wasn't challenged, but we didn't have evidence that challenged that. But Your Honor, it doesn't exist in the record.
You've got a problem. But why don't you go on and address the merits before we run out of time on that implied license question? Because it seems to me that you've got a problem bringing this within the Delaware case, because these are not the same party. They have a relationship, but they're distinct companies with only about a 30% stock ownership.
Sure. Your Honor, I want to take it back again to the summary judgment procedure, where the question is what evidence was in the record at that point. And at that
address the merits of the license question, okay?
Yes, Your Honor. On the merits, the evidence in the record was that this was purely a paper transaction where literally all that happened is that QSI walked drives right down their campus. They didn't even ship them to QCI.
So what? They're separate companies.
There was no evidence in the record at summary judgment suggesting that they weren't, in effect, having the exact same financial interest And, in fact, this notion of it being an arm's length transaction.
There were factual allegations being made in support of QCI's motion here, where they're saying, here are the facts, A, B, and C. And I think their argument is that you didn't countermand those. You didn't come in and say they're not telling the truth.
Your Honor, we did very much make the point that QSI and QCI function together as one entity that makes this just a paper transaction. They did not, they have the burden of proof. They did not put in the evidence that counsel just referenced in terms of there being less than 30% ownership, there being this, the notion of the arm's length transaction.
Wait a second, that information is in the record. How is it in the record?
It's in the record because there was a trial later at which some of those facts came out of the trial. And there was a second trial as well. But the other key point, Your Honor, is this notion of arm's length transactions when Dell is negotiating things, all of that, none of that was in the summary judgment.
Well, let me ask you hypothetically to assume that they are separate companies, that there's only a 30% ownership.
Okay.
How does this case then come within the Delaware case?
I think the Syrac case...
Isn't it clear that you can have a have-made license and sell it to Philips or to Sony and have it sold to an affiliated company? What's the matter with that? Why is that an evasion of the have-made license?
I think the Syrac case answers that question very directly, which is if the transaction between the company doing the making and the transaction then back with the company that buys it from the licensee is part of two halves of the same transaction, in that circumstance, it is a sham, is the term that Syrac uses. And the Syrac case says...
What's a sham about? I don't understand.
Because in that instance, it is indistinguishable from a sublicense. In other words, it's not a situation where the licensee has some separate third-party transaction where the licensee either specifies how something should be built or is retaining inventory. In this instance, every single drive in each one of these transactions that QSI makes is walked right over campus to QCI and deliver in order for them to
sell to them by, you're relying on the shipping arrangement, but in fact it goes back to Sony, and Sony sells it to QCI, right?
It doesn't go back to Sony. It never is.
No, shipped. Not physically, but the title, the ownership, is in Sony, and Sony sells it to QCI.
And, Your Honor, that's exactly how the Syrac court distinguishes DuPont.
Wait, answer my question. Isn't that what happens?
On paper, title would pass from one to the other, and a royalty would be paid.
Why isn't that enough?
Because what the Syrac court said is that if the Syrac facts had simply been a paper transaction, where the physical items don't move and it's nothing but a paper transaction, that would have been a sham. And all that's happened here is instead of having...
Syrac say that?
Syrac said that, Your Honor. That
where?
That is at 1387.
It says in DuPont the arrangement was a sham.
Correct. It's distinguishing its facts, Syrac, where it finds there is an implied license from DuPont. And it's saying in DuPont the issue
was... Well, so you have to show that this arrangement in this case was a sham. But I don't see that there's any proof that it's a sham.
Your Honor, the evidence in front of the district court, again, was that entities that are commonly owned on the same campus, on the same transaction, something is simply walked from one to the other... And
that makes it a sham?
That certainly raises the question of fact as to whether it's a sham, Your Honor. And that's all that we asked for in front of the district court. And while we don't think the record can be recreated, if you will, nonetheless, at most what would happen is there's simply a question of fact here that would have to be resolved. But on summary judgment, the evidence, again, the issue of us not putting in evidence that it was not a legitimate transaction has the burden of proof reversed. Every element proving this affirmative defense fell on Quanta. And as they acknowledged, there was no evidence at all in the summary judgment record to suggest that this transaction was legitimate. The discussion about arm's length transactions and everything, that was not in the summary judgment record.
What about patent exhaustion?
Your Honor,
the sales that you contend occurred abroad were made from what? To Sony, to QCI? Is that what we're talking about, those kinds of transactions?
Those would be the sales that Quanta is alleging would exhaust patents.
And surely Sony must have contemplated that those items that were sold were going to be brought to the United States, unlike the JS Photo situation.
Your Honor, there was absolutely no evidence in the summary judgment record of any sale in the United States whatsoever.
Assume hypothetically that Sony intended that the optical disk drives would be brought to the United States. Would that distinguish the JS Photo cases?
Your Honor, I don't think it would, in that the JS Photo cases draw the line in terms of there being a necessity, in terms of the simple territoriality requirement. Now, it would, I guess at some point you could get into the facts about whether or not there would be a fact dispute about where the sale really occurred, but in this case...
No, but I'm not talking about where the sale occurred. I'm assuming for the moment the sale occurred abroad, but Sony in making the sale says, we know that you were selling these so that you could bring them to the United States. Why wouldn't that distinguish the JS Photo case?
Your Honor, first of all, nothing like that happened. There was no suggestion of evidence like that. But in terms of how that would reconcile with the JS Photo cases, my understanding in the JS Photo cases is it's a fairly hard and fast rule in terms of the sale has to be in the United States. Now, the gray area would be when is the sale in the United States or not in the United States. And on there could be some fact issues. But in this
why shouldn't you have exhaustion if somebody makes a sale, if the place of sale is just an accident and it's contemplated that the item is going to be brought to the United States and the licensee or the patentee says, we know you're going to bring that to the United States, why shouldn't there be exhaustion?
Your Honor, under those facts, it would be a closer call. There was absolutely nothing like that in this record. In fact, they affirmatively disclaimed any knowledge of even QCI knowing where, or QSI or QCI knowing where things were going, and there was no evidence to suggest that Sony did anything other than simply accept a check. So those facts would get us into a grayer area, but there is nothing in the record.
Would that end up being disk-specific or order-specific?
Absolutely, it would, Your Honor.
Some of the computers are going to be sold in China, London, and other places.
Exactly. What we were told over and over again in discovery is that these entities have no idea where these different pieces are going, that they couldn't track them. And be that as it may, whether it goes that far, simple lack of evidence, there was absolutely no effort on the summary judgment stage for them to put in evidence suggesting U.S. sales. Their position was it doesn't matter, foreign sales cover. And we know that because in the appellate brief, the only thing they cite in the appellate brief to suggest there were U.S. sales is our opposition to their summary judgment motion. There's a reference to the fact that eventually there is a sale to Dell or whoever else, and that doesn't get them to summary judgment.
Do you have anything further?
I don't, Your Honor. I know that there was a reference to the hypothetical negotiation date. I can speak to that issue if the court has any questions on that topic. In this instance, the reason the hypothetical negotiation date was set where it is that Quanta's counsel was asked specifically by the district court, do you have any evidence that Quanta Computer, which is the only defendant that went to the jury, had any knowledge of the patent before 2006? The answer was no, we don't. The case law is clear that the hypothetical negotiation date cannot be earlier than when infringement began. Case law, this is only an indirect infringement case against Quanta Computers. Infringement could not begin before the date on which they had actual knowledge of the patent.
Okay, and for this purpose, you've decided to separate QSI and QCI.
No, Your Honor. Actually, in both instances, we say they are related entities, but they are not the same entity. And likewise, the district court made the same. To be clear, it's a very fact-intense issue. There was no suggestion. Now, if Quanta had come to the district court and said, Your Honor, actually, we believe that notice to QSI should count as notice to QCI, and here's the evidence as to why, that'd be one thing. But they didn't. They said, no, we have no evidence that QCI got any notice whatsoever. And so, again, these are both fact-intensive issues that have to be decided on the record that actually exists. And on the record that exists, both resolutions were absolutely correct.
So where in the record do we find the district court's reasoning for setting the date of 2006?
Your Honor, that is at...
What was the reasoning?
That is at JA31. There is a colloquy with the district court judge, and the district court judge asked counsel for Quanta, what's the earliest date that you had notice, that Quanta Computers had notice of 2000? I think it's 2006. Counsel, tell me, you have any evidence of anything earlier than 2006? Counsel for Quanta said, no, we don't. And the judge said, well, that's the date. The case law cited by Quanta suggests that where infringement began, but there is a limitation on damages, and the two examples in the case they cited are the six-year bar on damages and a marking issue on damages, you still start from the date infringement began. An artificial, not an artificial, but a separate limitation on damages, that's not this at all. Infringement, indirect infringement doesn't begin until they have notice.
So the judge's theory was you can't have it both ways. You can't treat them as separate for purposes of the implied license and then treat them as a single company for purposes of the hypothetical negotiation date, right?
No, Your Honor. I think with the judge...
You can't have it both ways? You said you treated them as totally separate? You can't have it both ways and treat them as the same here?
I'm sorry. That's what he told to Quanta. It's Quanta that...
Doesn't that same principle apply to you? You can't have it both ways?
Actually, no, Your Honor. The reason is that with respect to Quanta, in order to prove the hypothetical negotiation, it would actually have to be the same party, okay, for the notice to apply. It would have to be the actual same party, not really a related party. So they're saying on one, it's the same party, on the other, it's the, all we're saying in both instances is that they're different, but they're related. And that's exactly what the exhaustion order says. It says sales from QSI to QCI or other Quanta entities. So the judge's point was simply, it's not that they're the same, it's that they're related. And the fact that they're related means this is not an issue on which I can grant summary judgment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The court is correct that they never argued that the court did not grant summary judgment. And let me read you from Judge Ward's order. However, for purposes of the trial...
Which page is this on?
This is at JA-22. However, for purposes of the trial, the court advises the parties of the following holdings. The Quanta defendants do not have an implied license with respect to drives that are manufactured by QSI, Quanta Storage, and eventually sold to QCI, Quanta Computer, or another Quanta entity. The judge granted summary judgment. Even if he didn't, the court can rule on denial of a summary judgment under an abuse of discretion standard, but Judge Ward was very clear in his order that he was granting summary judgment on this issue. They didn't raise this issue, so I had to sort of scramble and find a few pages of what was actually in the record, and I just want to correct the record. It was very clear, JA-7113, about the relationship between QCI and QSI. That was made clear in the summary judgment briefing. On JA-7109, it was very clear that QCI obtained the majority of drives used in its QCI or in its computers from customers, and those customers include Dell, IBM, HP, Gateway, and Apple, all of whom are U.S. companies. So that's the best I could do in just a few minutes I was given, but I think the record was developed pretty clearly on this issue, both at the summary judgment stage and later at trial as well. Turning to the notice issue, if I may, I didn't have a chance to address the hypothetical negotiation date. I think the issue, the legal issue, is whether there, in an indirect infringement claim, the date of first infringement for purposes of a hypothetical negotiation should be the date of first sale, or should it be the date that a party had notice of the patent. And I think more consistent with the court's view that during a hypothetical negotiation, all the parties have full knowledge if you assume the party also knew about the patent, or the defendant also knew about the patent. You assume validity. You assume infringement. You should assume, even in the indirect infringement stage, that the parties would know about the patent on the date of first sale. If that's the law, and I didn't find any cases addressing this issue on point, but if that's the law...
Can we just assume they know it?
I would say you should assume that when a party makes a sale in the U.S., that should be the date of the hypothetical negotiation, even in the indirect infringement context.
Even if you're unaware of the patent, you're totally ignorant.
Well, if you're making sales in the United States, there's every incentive for the plaintiff, the patent holder, to approach you and ask for a license. So it seems reasonable to me that if you're going to assume validity and you're going to assume infringement, you should assume full knowledge on the part of the defendant as well. That would include knowledge of the patent, and you should set the negotiation at the date of first sale. If it is the date of first sale that controls instead of the notice date, the date of first sale by Quanta Computer was in 2003, that's in the record, by Quanta Storage was 2001. If notice is the proper date, then Quanta Storage had notice in 2002. If you're going to treat Quanta Storage and Quanta Computer as the same company, then you should assume that Quanta Computer also had notice back in 2002.
Okay, anything else?
Just on the exhaustion issue quickly, I didn't address exhaustion. I think the facts of the Jazz Photo case are distinguishable.
If you prevail on either exhaustion or on the implied license, then we don't need to worry about the date of the negotiation?
There are a few nominal sales that wouldn't be covered by exhaustion or implied license. At a 6% royalty, I think I calculated the damages is in the tens of thousands of dollars. It's a very nominal number of sales that were in our records. And we don't contend that those purchases in early 2000 directly from Quanta Storage to Quanta Computer should be covered by...
Just for purposes of us, in terms of work we have to do, would you withdraw your cross-appeal on that issue if you prevailed on either exhaustion or on the implied license?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
On the exhaustion, I think the Jazz Photo case could be distinguishable from the facts here, even if you assume a foreign sale. In this case, there's a worldwide license authorizing Sony and Philips to sell drives anywhere in the world. In Jazz Photo, the court believed that sale by Fujitsu of its products overseas may not have reflected the price of those. The sale of those products overseas may not have reflected its full patent rights. But that's different here, where you have a worldwide license, an already paid-up license. So I think the fact of Jazz Photo, even if you assume that all the sales here are overseas sales, are distinguishable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Garnett.
Thank you.
I will now hear argument on the Laser Dynamics appeal relating to the grant of the new trial.
Thank you, Your Honor. And can I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal on this
issue? Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court clearly erred in setting aside the first jury verdict in terms of damages and ordering a new trial. The district court did that on two bases, that the verdict was against the great weight of evidence and that the damages were excessive. This case turns on the Fifth Circuit standards and for evaluating that type of a judgment. The Fifth Circuit made clear that a new trial motion is looking at even if the winning party has sufficient evidence, did the other party have so much evidence and the record so one-sided that it's against the great weight of evidence. That's the Fifth Circuit standard.
Yeah, counsel, what's the quantitative basis in the record that supports a 6% royalty rate?
Your Honor, the quantitative basis in the record in the first trial was Mr. Murtha, who was the damages expert, looked at a series of the LES licensing report and then picked out two particular agreements in that report and used that as the basis to come to the 6% number. I want to be very clear about something, though. That was not the basis for the new trial. In fact, the district court specifically denied a request for a new trial on the question of whether or not 6% was an adequate basis or not. That's a JA006.
Okay, so the agreements you're talking about, those don't relate to the patent.
Your Honor, that's what the district court determined when there was a Daubert motion in the second trial.
What's the quantitative basis for the 6% royalty?
Your Honor, those agreements don't relate to the patent. They relate to similar technology. And the question of whether it was similar enough or not is a classic type of issue that would be addressed on Daubert. In this case, in the new trial order, the district court specifically said, I am not going to grant a new trial on that issue of the rates, which means the standard of review for this court is an absolute absence of evidence. And once there's testimony in the record that says 6% is the number, it cannot satisfy the absolute absence of evidence test in terms of the 6% rate. In the second trial, the 6% rate was based on agreements that were with respect to these patents, where there was a running royalty rate, one of them that was in the 8% range, another one that was in the 15% range, one of them was a lump sum for $6 million. So in the second trial, when there actually were Daubert objections...
That was the BenQ settlement?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was the BenQ settlement in the second trial. In terms of the standard...
Are you saying that a settlement on the doorsteps of courthouse, that's evidence of the market value?
Your Honor, the evidence in front of the district court was that all of these agreements were based on the threat of litigation, and that it wasn't... BenQ was just like the other 27 agreements that were the basis of Quanta. They were all inspired by litigation. And so getting on whether one is close enough or far enough away from litigation, our position was they all should have been excluded originally. And when the judge decided they were all going to come in, that's fine, but the good come in with the bad. In terms of the BenQ settlement, that's the closest to the hypothetical negotiation date. That is the hypothetical negotiation date. It's 2006. And in BenQ, because there was a sanction which said that the defendant lost some time in opening and closing in voir dire, it meant it was that much more difficult to put on a defense of infringement or life or invalidity. That made it that much more like a hypothetical negotiation in which you assume infringement and liability. So in the second trial, it was well set in terms of the 6% rate. In the first trial, the review for that would be, it was also well set on that record, but the review would simply be for a complete absence of evidence.
Why don't you tell us why you think Judge Ward made a terrible mistake when he decided that your adversary had not waived its right to challenge the original jury verdict even after entry of judgment?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That's the heart of this.
It is, Your Honor. A new trial motion on great weight of evidence only compares our stack of evidence with how big the other side's stack of evidence is. That's it in both Scott and the Conway case, when the Fifth Circuit reversed district court orders granting new trials and made clear you cannot, the fact that a judge disagrees with the integrity of a witness is not sufficient. Likewise, the Fifth Circuit said that although it's an abuse of discretion review, it's a heightened review, if you will, when you're talking about the great weight of evidence burden and that you can't use this for game law. This is the fundamental problem.
Maybe you and I aren't talking on the same wavelength. What I understood to be your main problem here was that the trial judge said, wait a second, even after I've entered judgment on a $58 million jury verdict, the other side is now complaining that the damages were excessive and I could reach that issue.
Right.
So you've got a first question about whether or not they preserved their right to challenge it, and if they did, then you're going to have an argument about how the whole market value rule wasn't implied, et cetera. But you've got to get over, you've got to get past this waiver issue.
Yes.
And as I understand it, your adversary filed a motion in limine, a Daubert motion, right at the get-go, saying any damages, any evidence on damages, other than these licenses that we put on, would be excessive, would be illegal, impermissible.
Correct.
So it would look, I'm just telling you where I'm coming from. To me like the question, the issue of excessiveness of damages was preserved for all time, if you will, by the Daubert motion that your adversary made.
Two responses to that. First of all, the Daubert motion said the rate that you have to rely on the agreements that were these past agreements because they set a rate, and therefore anything that goes beyond that would be excessive. The district court specifically rejected that.
I understand. But their point would be, yes, we made an objection. It got you know, we were overruled. So we had preserved the question for post-trial, post-verdict.
I'm jumping forward to the post-trial order. The new trial order said specifically that on that topic, this is at JA6, on that topic, on the question of whether or not these agreements would set a cap, I am rejecting the request for a new trial on that. The plaintiff put in evidence that the jury could believe.
No, I understand. We're still missing each other. I think you want to establish the fact that you think that the trial judge erred by entertaining the question of whether or not the first verdict was excessive in the first place.
Absolutely.
Because your view is that they waived that by not having raised it at some earlier stage in the game.
I want to be specific about that. It's not a complete waiver of filing a motion at all in terms of an excessive.
I understand.
But it's very close to that on this record, which is the only type of excessive damage motion that could have been filed is a motion that says there's not any evidence in the record to show this number. I mean, look at the Fifth Circuit cases. If the evidence is in the record that shows the number, it gets credited. That's, for example, the Caldera case. The evidence in this record certainly showed the number. That's what cannot happen by the district court is for the district court to start weighing the evidence and saying, I like this or I didn't like this. And to put a
Do we have the authority to do that?
The only place the district court would have the authority to do that would be under the great weight of evidence standard. And that's talking about the total stack of evidence on Quanta's side versus the stack of evidence on our side. And the standard would have to be that the stack of evidence on Quanta's side is so great that it overwhelms our stack. He didn't do that at all. He said, there's nothing over here. I'm going to come over here and look at it and make credibility determinations, in essence. And that's directly contrary to what Scott says he can do. And moreover, the evidence in the record was under any standard, would have...
Judge Ward said in his order that their adversary did not waive its right to complain about the jury verdict in its motion for a new trial.
Correct.
Now, what's my standard of review on that decision he made?
Okay. The standard of review in reviewing a motion for a new trial that was granted...
I'm on the waiver issue. He made a finding. He said they have not waived their right. Okay?
The question of whether or not...
That's like an entitlement issue. Somebody shows up after a trial, after a jury verdict, after a judgment is entered, and they come in and they say, Your Honor, I want a new trial. And the other side stands up and says, well, why? And he says, well, because your damage theory is not a good legal theory.
Sure.
And so, and the judge then, someone says, well, they can't make that argument. They waived it. They should have made it sooner. And the judge says, no, I disagree with you. It's not waived. So it's just the waiver issue.
Just the waiver issue. It would be an abuse of discretion standard that the Fifth Circuit says is a heightened review abuse of discretion. But that said, when all the district court is doing is applying procedures and standards of review, an application of the wrong standard of review is by definition an abuse of discretion. So all the standard has determined whether or not something was waived and what kinds of challenges can be made post-trial would be an abuse of discretion. Given that here, the district court applied the wrong standard in coming to the determination that there wasn't a waiver, it would be an abuse of discretion. Your Honor, I'll go into my reserve rebuttal time for just 1 minute if I could.
Well, why don't you? I think you're out of time. You're over your time. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Here, the $52 million verdict was 195 times greater than the largest license fee in the 16 non-litigation license agreements entered into trial.
We know that.
So on these guys,
your client got a big adverse jury verdict against it on a theory of damages that went to the jury that was wrong, but it went there. You didn't object. The verdict comes out, and you go and you say, oh, my goodness. We want a new trial, but you hadn't raised any of these issues before. So why isn't the district court judge abusing his discretion when he says you didn't waive the right to make this challenge?
Well, he didn't abuse his discretion, one, because he applied the correct standard, which is whether the verdict is excessive or against the great weight of evidence or excessive based upon any rational appraisal or estimate of damages. That is the standard that he should have applied, not an absolute absence of evidence standard. That's on denial of a new trial motion. So that's not the evidence at all here.
There was evidence of damages, and there was no objection on your part as to sufficiency during the trial.
Well, we filed a Daubert motion, and we filed a motion in limine objecting to Mr. Murtha's methodology on the grounds that he should not apply a royalty rate to the price of the computer or to the price of the optical disk drive, and that his $52 million damage figure was excessive.
Once you saw the course of the evidence being presented, you didn't object at that time and say, look, we're not supposed to be getting into this area.
Well, there's no requirement in seeking a new trial that you have filed, first of all, a Daubert motion or a motion in limine. There's no requirement at all.
You have a problem in the sense that the district court could have said you waived, maybe on the not on the great weight of the evidence, but you could have waived this argument about the entire market value rule. You could have said that. You didn't raise it, therefore we're not going to consider it, right?
I don't believe he could have waived. He could have said that because one of the grounds for finding...
Okay, well, assuming it wasn't raised earlier, you could have said, I'm not going to consider it, right?
I don't think that would have been legally correct because one of the grounds in granting a new trial...
You're arguing with my hypothetical. My hypothetical is you didn't raise it. If you didn't raise it, the district court could say, too bad, I'm not going to consider it, right?
I don't believe so, but... I mean, he could have said that, sure, but would that be legally correct?
If he has his discretion to do so, and no, appellate court would reverse him.
I'm not sure if an appellate court would reverse him, but I believe that
let's assume that. But as I understand the Fifth Circuit law, also, if the district court decides that he is going to consider the issue and he's going to excuse the waiver, then he can do it and that it will be reviewed by the Court of Appeals on the merits of the issue. In other words, the district court can excuse the waiver. Are you familiar with those cases?
I'm not familiar with those cases, and I don't believe that the district court excused the waiver here. That's why. And I don't think that was...
You don't think he excused the waiver?
I don't think there was a waiver. I think when you're weighing the great weight of the evidence, they suggest...
But if there was a waiver, he excused it.
If there was a waiver, he excused it. But he expressly found that there was no waiver. That's in his order. He expressly found it. He was closer to the situations. He knew what the parties were arguing. He knew our position from the very beginning. And he decided that there was going to be no waiver. They argued, and I think it's very important to keep in mind, that they were never applying the entire market value rule. Back then, and to this day, they argued that. When we got to, and maybe on a Daubert challenge, he was willing to say, okay, I'll let you put that on a trial, and I'll listen to what Mr. Murtha has to say. But when they got to trial, what did they do? They applied the entire market value rule. And at that point, he said, I'm not going to allow that on the new trial motion.
Bring me back for just a second to either your motion in limine or your Daubert motion. You talked over it very quickly. You said something about the royalty rate. You were suggesting that there was some, in either one of those motions, you were somehow saying that you couldn't compute a royalty rate based on the computer?
Yes, we did say that.
Those motions?
It is. There should be no...
Can you tell me in the record I could just find it? I mean, what you're telling me is that you put the seed of the objection to the whole market rule in your Daubert motion or in your other motion, right?
I do think we did in this sense. We argued that that Mr. Murtha should not be allowed to apply a royalty rate to the price of the computer or to the price of an optical disk drive.
To the price of the computer.
Right. And that is in our Daubert motion or our JMAL motion. I think it's in both, actually. So we made those arguments to the district court. He was familiar with our arguments. He was the person listening to the evidence.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get, because I'm looking in my own mind to see what's the quality of the objection you were making initially at the trial for purposes of whether or not a trial judge later on could say in his mind he thought you had sufficiently preserved an issue that he'll allow you to bring it back up.
Yes, and I guess that's my point, Your Honors, is that I think he was aware of this issue. He was familiar with the objections we were making, and he expressly found...
Why do you let the issue go to the jury? why does a district court judge who's aware of the fact that he knows what the whole market rule is as well as we do.
He does. He's a very smart
He doesn't need Unilog. He knows about right height. And so why on earth would he let this issue go to the jury? So they've got an illegal theory in front of them.
Well, in the Unilog case, for example, the district court said, once the total revenue figure is out of the bag, there's no fixing it.
Once it was out of the bag, did the judge didn't call a bench a conference, or you didn't stand up and object?
We had filed the Dalbert and the motion to eliminate, and you're right, we didn't stand up and object. On the other hand, Judge Ward is a very savvy trial judge, and I believe he knew at that point when they were comparing $2.6 billion in revenue to their damage claim of $52 million that they were doing what they said they weren't going to do and apply the entire market value rule. Once that $2.6 billion figure was out and the jury heard it, at that point, it's out of the bag. And in Unilog, the court said there's no instruction that I can give to a jury that will correct that. And I'm looking into Judge Ward's mind, but perhaps that's what
why,
he was
why thinking. Wasn't the, why didn't he order a new trial on that basis then?
He did order a new trial on the basis of the entire market value rule. That was an incorrect application of the entire market value rule.
No, it was on the basis of the size of the award.
It was, but he said that the award was too large because it reflected an improper application of the entire market value rule for which there was no basis in the evidence to support the application of
the
rule.
Well, he's in essence saying when he grants your motion, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have let this issue go to the jury, right?
Yes, or
I should have, waked up and leaned over and said, wait a second, if I send this to the jury and they come back with a great big verdict, then I'm going to have to upset it and send it back and have another trial.
Yes, that wouldn't be a prudent. It's already in the evidence, the jury's heard it. There's nothing I can do to correct it. At this point, they've argued, they've compared the $52 million figure against $2.6 billion in sale. There's nothing I can do to correct this.
So let's see what the jury does, and then I'll figure out whether I should correct it in some way.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's what happened. Judge Ward was very close to these arguments, and he expressed his value in the waiver. And he was the person on the ground listening to the counsel argue this issue. And he did look at Mr. Murtha's $52 million figure in deciding whether to grant a new trial. He just said, well, if against that is an improper application of the entire market value rule, so he didn't just discard it as counsel for Lizard and Emmick suggests. He looked at it, but it was evidence that he is not required to credit. He is allowed to weigh the evidence on a new trial motion. He can do that. That's actually his duty and his job. And he exercised that duty here, found that there was an error of law, and granted a new trial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Garda. Mr. Garda, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with respect to this issue of waiver, the district court didn't say that there was no waiver per se. What he said is that you can't waive the right to seek a new trial. But what the Fifth Circuit said is, well, that's always true. You can't waive the right to seek a new trial. The bases on which you can argue for a new trial are strictly limited depending on what happened in the record before that. You can't use a new trial to argue a Daubert motion. You can't use it...
Unless the district court lets you.
There is no case law that suggests that can happen. In fact, both the two instances when Fifth Circuit overturned that are the Conway case.
Well, take a look at Gary at 661 Fed 3rd at 248. It's a Fifth Circuit case from last year.
Not cited in the briefs.
The other point along that is in the Umar case, this court can be certain about it, actually reverse a grant of a new trial and both the JMAL side and the new trial. And on the JMAL side, that it's improper for the court to make a comment about the expert that the claim for our user, there is no Daubert motion. On the new trial side, well, for the same reason that we're reversing the new trial order. In this instance, the district court had to accept the evidence that was in the record. And the balancing, the weighing they can do, isn't to say, I don't find it credible. It's to say the other side had overwhelming evidence.
Can I ask a point of information? I'm sorry, that's a little off key for what the topic is here, but it's a question was asked of your adversary earlier in a different context. Assume for purposes of argument that we were to agree with you that the original verdict has to be reinstated, but assume we disagree with you and find that there was an implied license and or exhaustion. How much of the $58 million, how much of the $50 million charge verdict will be wiped out by the license?
Your Honor, I'll have to.
I mean, we didn't get a, we got a large part discussion before. I mean, is it?
I think with the explanation that a large part, I think that's right. I'd have to get back to the specific number. The other issue, I think, is
are we talking about the same number, same amount of product?
We
both
are.
Trials, same drives?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So presumably the answer would be the same.
That's correct. The other point I wanted to make is that under no circumstances we agree that that issue could be decided in license both ways on summary judgment. In other words, at the very least, it would simply go back for a trial on that issue of
well, the question is whether or not you waived the right to make that argument.
Well, we, in our
here. We had that discussion earlier.
Yes, Your Honor. But we never said anything in our brief to suggest that the alternative to us winning summary judgment would be the other side. That middle ground, it was just a fact question. We never said anything to suggest that would be the outcome.
Well, that's your problem, is that you didn't say anything.
Well,
silence speaks
volumes. Well, it does on that issue. Even if you have standard procedure for both sides file summary judgment, that's not an indication that there couldn't be an outcome where neither side wins the fact question. So even if we have assumed the summary judgment question, that doesn't mean that we're going to go back to the trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly. We thank both counsel, and the case is submitted.